Sarah Smarsh is a name you might be starting to hear. She's the author of a new book about the forces that shaped her Kansas childhood, forces mainly of poverty. The book is a celebration of the particular place she's from and the people who raised her, but it's also an indictment of class in this country, or, as Sarah puts it, what it means to be a poor child in a rich country founded on the promise of equality. The book is Heartland, and I'm excited to be talking to Sarah, not just because her book is important, but because she's my friend, and she's been working on telling this story the whole time I've known her. Sarah Smarsh, welcome to Central Standard.
It is so good to be back and talking with you again, Gina.
You did it.
I did, and as you know, it was a long time in the doing, so yeah, it's a pretty exciting moment.
So here's the deal. Everyone keeps calling this a memoir, and I would not call it that.
Mm.
I think that this is a book-length personal essay. It has a lot of stories in it, but I think you have a point to make. And I think that point is sort of encapsulated in that quote I just read, perhaps. I'm curious what you think about that. The idea that it's time to hear what it means to be a poor child in a rich country founded on the promise of equality.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that memoir, of course, is a component of the narrative. As you suggest, it is more than that, or at least people's associations with that genre, in that it's not just a tale of my coming of age. And I absolutely do have a point. It's really a family story, which grounds a larger discussion about public policy and political and economic forces that are related to the private, but entirely public. So, I think that the hope in emphasizing that piece of the story is to signal to readers in a literary landscape right now that is rife with overtly political writing, that this is in fact a very intimate story. But as you say, it's and as you know, as a fellow scribe, it's sometimes hard to categorize nonfiction, and so I will take it as a compliment if it's hard to label this book.
Yeah, totally. You know what I was noticing is that the stories themselves, you know, some of them I've heard, some of them I haven't, but that there's this sort of beautifully described lived experience that I know you have been working on putting into words for so many years. But what you have done in very recent years is you have gone back and researched the policy and politics that shaped your experiences, and you have layered that in here. What was that like for you? We'll get to your story in a second, but what was it like to kind of research your own story in that way?
Right. Well, I think one of the beautiful ways in which what you described was kind of organic and just happened by default is that, you know, I was working as a journalist to pay the bills while I had this kind of personal project of my own creative passion tucked away in a drawer, and along the way, I just as a reporter was gaining the language and understandings for articulating the personal passages that I was writing. So it kind of just happened naturally then that I was better equipped to layer in, as you say, an awareness of why this private story matters in a bigger way about this moment in our country. And so, but as far as, you know, it was such a long writing process and research journey that was probably the great creative challenge structurally of the book once I realized that I wanted to integrate that piece of the narrative, which, as you say, came later in my process than some of the most personal narratives within the book were written truly over a decade ago. And you're right that the journalistic hat I wear was accomplished in more recent years, and getting that all to sing together was quite a creative challenge.
I have to admit that since we're friends, I've had the privilege of seeing earlier drafts of this book and hearing about your earlier ideas about what it would be. Mm. And I remember at the very beginning, it was going to be the story of one person in your family, as you imagined it, your grandmother, who raised you, or at least in part raised you.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And that seems to have taken a real transformation. I mean, the story that frames both the narrative and some aspects of your life, at least as you've written about it, is the story of your mom getting pregnant as a teenager. Mm-hmm. And you write that you were in a poor girl's lining like a penny in a purse, not worth much, but kept in production. That is a painful sentence even to read, much less write. But take me through that process of realizing that this wasn't just the story of your grandmother.
Yeah, this is a question that so few folks know to ask. And it's because, as you say, you had a vantage early on when I did indeed see this as, you know, my first pass at putting the book together. I got a couple of research grants when I was a senior at the University of Kansas in 2002, a lifetime ago in American politics. At that moment, this woman who had raised me, this vivacious, too young to be a grandma, salty Midwestern broad, Betty, my maternal grandmother, was, you know, always such a captivating character for me as someone who was at once, you know, loved her dearly as my grandmother, but also was a budding writer who was sensitive just to story. And I knew that she had lived a particularly wild one, even within the wild context of poverty. And so the initial passes at the book and piecing together my family story were really centered on her. I still, in a lot of ways, think of her as kind of the heart of the book or its star in some ways. But I think that just, as I expanded my understanding of the story and like why, you know, I feel at a gut level like there's something other, as we say, about my life experience, and it has to do with class and gender and place. As I expanded my awareness of that relevance of the private story, it became more of a generational tale about my family. And of course, the generation between Betty and myself is my mother, Jeannie. And I couldn't write about Betty's life without learning about my mother's upbringing, which was, you know, really a personal catharsis and journey in a lot of ways, as deep creative projects often are. And it became clear to me that I couldn't talk about Betty without talking a lot about Jeannie too, and for that matter, a lot of other family members and even several generations back. None of us exist in a vacuum in terms of who we are or the forces at work in our lives. And I hope that this book really is a family story now.
Take me into some of what you did come to understand about your mom, Jeannie, as you looked back at your grandmother Betty's life.
Sure. So the painful passage that you read about my mother's teen pregnancy, she was 17 when I was conceived. And, you know, I was aware of that growing up. And I would say that that was keen and sometimes keenly painful fact in my life, just because of the difficulties it presented my mother, and in which I then had no choice but to absorb it as her child. When I really examined that piece of the family puzzle, and then having started this book as sort of rooted with Betty's character, it was like, whoa, Betty was also a teen mother. And then I got to researching, and it turns out, as far as I can find it back in my direct maternal line, we're talking like back to when women wore corsets, and prior to that, there's no records, and women had babies very young at that time, regardless of class. It's safe to say that I am the first female in my direct maternal line to not have a child as a teenager. And, you know, this is something that, apart from my work as a writer, I was certainly, I sensed at some sort of like cellular level, and my very direct mission statement to break that cycle is part of the book. But in terms of just why it matters to a story about poverty, the most common type of poor household unit in this country is the single mother, and we don't talk about women's stories enough within our discourse about the working poor or American poverty, to my mind. And there are several very gender specific aspects to the experience, but one of the uniquely female experiences of poverty is the relationship between having a physical womb and being a would be creator of life and being poor. So poverty makes motherhood harder, and motherhood makes poverty harder. And the cyclical ways in which this work and the cultural ways in which teen pregnancy can become sort of entrenched in a family experience have everything to do with class and the book's broader public themes.
One of the just most painful stories for me to read in this book was the story of Betty, your grandmother. I had heard you talk before about that she had married many times and mm-hmm. That you all had moved together many times. Mm-hmm. And what I came to understand reading this book was why.
Yeah, so for the transience of Betty's life when she was a very young woman and a teenager in the 60s and 70s had a lot to do, yes, in part, there's the reality of that life where, there's an eviction notice because the rent can't be paid and then you're on to the next. But specifically for women and for very young women like her, sometimes she was just fleeing for her physical survival from abusive men who exist at every rung of the socioeconomic ladder, but who are harder to escape for women who don't have any money, and particularly at a moment when they were in large part barred from the workforce. So as a very young, as a teenage mother in the 60s, Betty fled my biological grandfather for her own safety and that of my young mother. And then she ended up with, she got pregnant again while working as a diner waitress in Lyman, Colorado, and married that man, and he also was abusive. When she tried to flee him, things got complicated because he essentially used his small town ties and leveraged his essentially power as a man within that community to get custody of her son. And she was told in the court system that she needed to show that that she had a provider and a stable household. So this was all code for, who is the man of the house. And she, her whole life had worked harder than probably any man that she knew. And yet she was shamed in the court system where she's trying to get custody of her son back from an abusive man for being a young divorced mother and a single woman. And so she remarried then at the advice of male attorneys who said, you're never going to get your son back if you're single. And the reality of her life was such that she wasn't, and the patterns of her life were such that then that next husband too would be from a sort of dangerous lot. So the cycle went around and round, and so what would appear off, I think, maybe to say a middle class reader as just erratic behavior on her part or lack of common sense or bad judgments, actually, as so often is the case in terms of decision making within poverty, she actually was making the right decisions in an impossible situation she just couldn't win.
So I'm getting chills just even preparing to ask you this question. This book is often addressed to someone who you refer to as you. I mean, you speak mm-hmm. directly to this other entity, mm-hmm. and it's the daughter you did not have young.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's the way to put it. Like the daughter.
Yeah, I think that's okay. Yeah. That's perfect. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, and my mom really was more like my sister in some ways in terms of the closeness of our age. And as you mentioned earlier, her mother, my grandma, stepped in and was kind of a second mom along the way sometimes. Because of this, I understood that there was something about having a baby very young that was particularly difficult, maybe especially for women who didn't have a lot of money. And so while I was a precocious kid in a lot of ways, nonetheless, I think a sort of curious feature of my psyche that developed in that space as a young female was just a kind of hyper-awareness of my would-be role as a mother and a very specific and direct intention at a very young age that I would not become pregnant or bring a child into a world like the one that I was born into. This is not to say it was an entirely miserable world, and I write about the joys and love that were there in those moments. But it was a hard life, and I understood that if I wanted to accomplish the things that I intended to do as a bookish, ambitious kid, if I were to have a baby, I was going to make sure that happened once I was financially stable, as they say. Now, a lot of people might hold that same aspiration for similar reasons. I don't know. For me, the way that played out in my mind is I would have this very deep internal dialogue with that would-be child. And it was often for the purpose, actually, and paradoxically, of instructing myself and guiding my own decisions. So I would say to myself, what would I want for my daughter? And since I was aspiring to have the sort of life that I would want to give, someone that I deemed most precious, that was a quick way of overriding any sort of bad circuitry or programming or environmental lessons I had received. If I regarded this entity that I knew I would love more than anything, and I had a decision to make, what would I want for my daughter? What would I tell my daughter to do? Even when I was like 15 years old, I would ask that question, and it was a real guiding light for me in my development. And it ended up being a dialogue that I wanted to let the reader in on, and I did. And when I brought that layer into the story, then all the other pieces started clicking and flowing mystically enough. So,
Something about that the sentence is directed at your would-be daughter who was not born into a teenage pregnancy and into the environment you're describing for your own childhood. The fact that those sentences begin with you, I think also asks people to imagine themselves by sheer chance landing in the same world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just, as a writer, of course, as a journalist, I have found myself essentially in the role of commentator often, but really my core professionally and creatively is I am a writer. I happen to write about things that make their way into political discussions of current events. But for me, these questions about like the significance of the use of the second person or how we label a particular piece of nonfiction craft, this is my bread and butter as a creative person. And so the second person is something I have thought a lot about, and I've played with it before in my essays. And it does seem to hold a particular power in, gently forcing, I would say, the willful participant, the reader, to even at some subconscious level be signaled into stepping into the shoes of some other person or experience.
Sarah Smarsh is the author of Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we'll get back to this conversation in just a minute. Still to come, the story of Sarah's dad, a farmer, carpenter, and poet. He wrote on 2x4s. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm talking to author Sarah Smarsh. She lives in Wichita, but she's on a whirlwind tour of the country with her new book, Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Sarah, you write about, I guess I would say, the unprotectedness of a rural childhood, especially in the context of poverty. And in some of those stories, I think it's fair to say you show a fun side to that. You've got some pretty wild scenes on the farm. But there's another side to it, too, which you see reflected in a story about a kitten. There's this mama cat on a farm where you spent a lot of your childhood and she'd had babies. Do you know the story I'm talking about?
Sure. Yeah. And a lot of people bring up that scene. I think it, you know, it is visceral, and maybe a lot of kids have some sort of parallel memory to this. I don't know. The significance and meaning I put onto it is specific to my story, which is, you know, I would go out and check on this litter of kittens in our rural place. And one day that I went out to sort of pet them and have, you know, there's no neighbors where I grew up. So a lot of my best friends were animals, as is a common situation for farm kids. The kittens, it turned out, had been gnawed through at the neck by some sort of critter, maybe a possum or a coyote. And this was, you know, a disturbing event for me. These little kittens that I cared for, and then I went to pet them and see the blood trailing away from their neck. And, you know, when I was a little kid and this happened, of course, I didn't have any big metaphorical significance for it. But I do think that it's accurate to say that there is some parallel between, you know, a helpless animal, baby who's mother goes off by necessity to hunt for to feed them or to, you know, restore herself so that she can nurse them. And in that moment of vulnerability, when their caretaker is away, they encounter danger, and in this case it was mortal. So, you know, as a kid growing up, I often was without a babysitter for lack of money to afford one, and parents are working, and kids at that socioeconomic station often are fending for themselves in a lot of ways. And that means a particular vulnerability in all sorts of ways, whether it has to do with bad grown-ups, bad teachers, just the physical dangers of the world. And the rural place that I was had plenty. So there was a beautiful freedom about my childhood, and that sort of early independence, but it definitely came with peril.
Your childhood was split between the rural environment on this farm and Wichita, mm-hmm. which is the biggest city in Kansas. And
yes.
Betty at a certain stage in her life starts working for a judge, and you have this sort of unique access to a whole different kind of world. As I don't know how old you were when this was happening, but can you mm-hmm. tell some of that story? Because this is another piece of your story that I don't think a lot of people have heard.
So as I write in the book, the farm that I grew up on was 30 miles west of Wichita. And so that proximity, while that's a long drive, and while that means that for most of my upbringing I was in rural school districts, and we felt very remote, and it was a pre-internet moment. We didn't even have cable television. You know, I definitely sensed a geographic disconnect or isolation. Yet it was a different experience than, say, growing up rural in like the most western reaches of the High Plains in Kansas. So you know, we could be at some store in Wichita in less than an hour if we had the gas to get there. And my grandmother Betty, as you said, worked at the Sedgwick County Courthouse in downtown Wichita. The way that happened, she was had spent her life, you know, waiting tables in at truck stops and working on factory floors. In the 1970s, came along some federal legislation called Title IX, and included in that was federal grants for women to receive training to enter pieces of the workforce they had previously been essentially prohibited from entering. So she, with that support, went to what they called business school. So she got, you know, she learned how to type, how to file things, and professional office etiquette. And these are sort of class markers that were in some ways utterly foreign to our place, where people work on construction sites and in restaurants. And factories. So with those skills, she landed a gig as a secretary at the courthouse, and then she worked her way up, and she was a subpoena officer for a time. And then by the time I was a little kid, she was working as a probation officer, essentially charged with counseling and keeping tabs on newly freed, convicted members of the community in the criminal court system. So talked earlier about how there wasn't a lot of money going around for babysitters during the summertime when I didn't have public school to go to and my parents were working. I would tag along with my grandma Betty to her courthouse job and just sort of scamper around this courthouse, and she'd send me on errands, and the attorneys would laugh, and so, you know, for me it just felt like this incredibly fancy place. My grandma had on her, like, you know, high heels from Kmart, but she's like clicking across this clean marble floor and 11 stories might as well have been a skyscraper to my eyes from rural Kansas. And I just found this a very at once glamorous place, but also hard-edged place that was in the business of, in theory, finding out what happened, getting to the truth, getting to the bottom of things. And these, as a future journalist, were aspects of our court system that piqued my interest, and I really see that as a formative moment, even in my journalistic career, but definitely in my awareness of how society works. And, you know, it was clear from knowing good people like my grandma and the judge that she worked for that system often failed people, but also within that system there were good people who were trying to do the right thing. It was a real lesson in the gulf that can sometimes exist between systemic forces and good people trying to get it right.
Another character who does not, in a previous version of this that I read, I did not really get to know this character very well, is your dad. And you mm-hmm. write about him as a construction worker, farmer, but also poet. A poet in an atmosphere where maybe you write that masculinity isn't really defined through poetry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, of the myriad factors that led to the outcomes of my life, and, you know, I'll never know all of them, certainly, but one of them is that my mother chose a man who would be my father, who is a kind and gentle person, and that was really breaking a cycle within her family, where a lot of the ex-husbands often and fathers were abusive in various ways, from physical to mental and psychological, and my dad was none of those things. You know, he had his struggles and his own demons, but he was not cruel to me, and in fact he was a gentle presence, and often was the one that got me ready for school rather than my mom, even as he's this, you know, construction worker with a beard and a flannel shirt that people would maybe stereotype as a particular kind of man. He would write little poems on slips of paper and put them in my room. And I actually have this sounds like too romantic to be true, but he actually once wrote a poem with a carpenter's pencil on a little scrap of 2x4 that I still have. And you know, he was doing those things like with zero self-awareness about what that might mean, zero performance to it because there was nobody there to see it. He just has the heart of a poet, and a lot of the men that I knew, my grandfather in that farmhouse I grew up in was also a very sweet man who actually the would-be daughter that I talk about in the book is named August in part because that was my grandpa's middle name. So, you know, men, while I want to tell the stories of women that I think get overlooked about the working class or the working poor, I also want to hopefully provide some sort of corrective or complication to the idea that all the men in those spaces are a certain way.
You're right in this book that nothing was more painful to you than true things being denied. And you're saying that in the sense of hoping that someone close to you will tell you how they feel about you. But I take that also as part of the mission of this book, Heartland. because you also write this sentence. What's peculiar about the class system in the United States is that for centuries, we denied that it existed. And I wonder if part of this book is just an assertion that not just do you exist, but that a lot of people who are not, who have not landed in a place in life where they can write their own book that we are all reading and talking about on the radio, that they exist too. And their stories might not be exactly like yours, but that they exist, that this, that class exists.
Yeah, that denial about the class structure of our country, where we've told ourselves we're a meritocracy and we have this thing called the American dream, that suggests that the outcomes of people's lives somehow correlate to how hard they work or what they deserve or what they earn. Those repetitive narratives are not just misleading and inaccurate. They're also, they also sort of make for an invalidation of so many lives who have, you know, the self-worth is immense. The hard work is real. The integrity cannot be denied. And yet their outcomes are lacking and sometimes tragic. That is a story that we have been reluctant to face as a country, I think, because it means then that the stories that we tell ourselves about how our society work must not be correct. And yeah, when I was a kid, you know, I didn't see my story anywhere, and I absolutely wrote this book in some ways because it is the book that I wish would have existed when I was a kid. Now, of course, there were all sorts of narratives that I connected with and in various ways, and they weren't necessarily told from the perspective of a rural Kansas farm kid. But there's something important, I think, about the specificity of it. You know, I remember talking to my publisher about the cover, and it's like, I want that horizon to be flat. And I'll tell you why, because that is the horizon I know. And in Kansas, everybody laughs when they see the representation of Kansas with mountains soaring in the distance. And so the universal truth is critical, but there is also a validation in the specificity that is so often missed or disregarded or gotten wrong. And, you know, I'm not here to say like, oh, I had this great individual triumph. Read my tale of hard work. I'm here to say whatever happened in my life is actually the exception to the rule in socioeconomic terms. And while I would never claim to speak for anyone but myself, I do know from the readers I hear from and the folks who come through lines at events that this remains somehow a story that is undertold to work hard and be broke in the richest country on earth. And yeah, people from all sorts of walks of life, not just Kansas, relate to that. Somehow it has been invalidated, and with that can come a sense of shame when what you sense about your own life is trouble and woe that your own society is telling you is not a trouble and not a woe in any social way. It's on you. So yeah, I hope that this book will allow people to feel seen and heard.
I know that there is obviously no longer any chance that you are going to be a teen mother, but I wonder if, and I know that you had a moment of really recognizing that very clearly, but I do wonder if you still ever ask yourself when you're not sure what to do, what you would tell your daughter, because as you know, we never outgrow the need for advice.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I have found that, you know, I guess this is the more common parlance is life hack. I think it's a solid life hack. And I still do that sometimes, because the mental trick of it is, if you are, for your gender or your poverty or your skin color or heck, just being alive on earth, for whatever reason you have been, your own self-worth has been challenged or discredited or suggested to be less than it is, then your decision making might, even if you don't consciously believe those negative messages, you might start making decisions in a way that reveals that subconsciously they dug in and they told you you didn't deserve or you weren't worth what you do deserve and what you are worth. And So you can override that, I've found, or at least I can, by summoning, you know, what if there was this innocent, precious child I'm charged with protecting, what's the right decision for her or for him? That's a real quick way to override the negative messages that one might carry about herself, and make a decision from the place of ultimate integrity and what some people might call the higher self.
Well, Sarah, congratulations on Heartland, your new book, and I can't wait to come hear you speak tonight.
Thank you, Gina. I'm so excited to come to Kansas City.
Sarah Smarsh is reading from Heartland tonight in Kansas City. It's a Rainy Day Books event at the Plaza branch of the library, and it starts at 6:30 p.m. You can find out more on the Rainy Day website, and we'll link to all the info with this interview at kcur.org/centralstandard. Also, you may remember that we spoke with Sarah the morning after the 2016 presidential election. Sarah had been out making this very controversial argument that it was not specifically working class white America outvoting for Trump.
There's no disproportionate support among the white working class. Of course, there are members of them that supported Trump, but this kind of hyperfixation by the media on their grievances and parsing the reasons why they were for the Trump ticket sort of allowed quiet, I would say, white suburban vote that is not going to show up at a Trump rally and scream hateful words, being as they have social capital to lose if they did so. There they were at the polls yesterday, and some of us are not surprised, and I don't relish the fact, but it's the case that a classist media, in part, was complicit.
We will link to that conversation as well if you want to hear Sarah's analysis. kcur.org/centralstandard. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now let's meet a Kansas City artist participating in the big Open Spaces Festival here in town. Jillian Youngbird has taken an abandoned building that used to house the old Lakeside Nature Center in Swope Park, and she's created these life-sized scenes that you can observe by looking in through the windows. Jillian, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
We'll get back to the shelter itself. What I did not mention just now is that all the characters in the scenes you've created are people with bird heads.
Yes. Yeah, they're kind of like a mixture between a human and a bird or an animal. They are covered from head to toe in chicken feathers, and then they have clothing on. They're made from all recycled and reclaimed materials.
You've been creating these kinds of hybrids of people and animals for a long time, and I want to talk to you about that shortly, but can you tell me more about the scenes that these people birds are involved in?
Yeah, it's funny because the way that I kind of wanted them to work is that, they were originally going to be in a different location, and it was going to be an entirely different story. They were going to be like in Western wear, and there were going to be cacti, and it was going to be sort of this adventure scene where you're wondering like where they're going and what kind of like crazy adventures they're getting themselves into. But the location ended up changing halfway through the process, and when I found out it was going to be at the Lakeside Nature Center, I had to sort of change what I was doing.
And again, I should say it's not the current Lakeside
Nature Center. Right, it's the abandoned one. But yeah, once I found out it was going to be there, I sort of had to approach it differently. That sort of story didn't quite fit. And so it became more of a story about these birds that are sort of struggling and maybe not going on adventures, just trying to survive and taking shelter. So
there were some things that you found in the shelter when you started checking out the space that you incorporated. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. When I got to the space and saw it for the first time, I could tell that, I mean, it's sort of in disarray. It's been abandoned for quite some time. There was a lot of trash. You could tell people human beings had been taking shelter in and around the area.
How could you tell that?
We found blankets and coats and pillows, you know, things like that, and a lot of trash. So I sort of approached it in a way where you could look at these birds and see that they were, just staying there to try to keep going. And yeah, we used sticks from around the area to make a nest for them. There was a trash barrel that we used to, you know, as their cooking device. So
you mentioned that the bird people that you created for this series of stories that you kind of created visually, that they were meant to be in Western wear among cacti and things like mm-hmm. that. Working with sort of like the Western mythology of America in some ways is part of what you've been doing for a long time. And it's part of you working with your own Native American background.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of conflict going on within me making all these works. Nature is a huge theme in what I do, and animals. But yeah, the Western stuff as well, because there is an internal struggle within me that I am, you know, part Native American and European background, and those two have clashed for a very long time. So it's like a war within myself that I'm trying to reconcile by making things that are maybe a little humorous and maybe address it in a way that disarms people a little bit to the conversation.
So. Yeah. So I want to get back to animal heads, because don't mean to be obsessed with that, but it is a striking feature of your work, people and animal heads. You've been inserting people with giant animal heads into the urban Kansas City landscape for a while, and it can have sort of a comical effect just to see these scenes. But I actually don't get the idea that it's just supposed to be funny.
No, it's not just supposed to be funny. The first one that I made was a bird, actually, and I made it when I was studying traditional Cherokee masks. And that one was kind of a failure. It was made out of chicken wire. It was huge and cumbersome and really uncomfortable. And then the second one that I made it during a time when there were wildfires going on in Colorado, and there was a lot of news stories about bears coming into residential areas because they're sort of being pushed out of their natural environment. And so that was when I made a bear head, and I sort of inserted myself into people's daily lives and maybe made them a little uncomfortable at times, but...
So I want to talk to you about that. You called it the Bear in the City Project, and I absolutely love looking at the photo documentation of that whole thing. There's something very tense about one particular photo where I think it's you wearing the bear head,
right? Yeah, it's me.
So you've got this big bear head on, but you're sitting out in the middle of the street with, like, your people legs kind of splayed out, and you're sitting in front of a police car that's parked, and your hands are behind your back as though maybe you are in handcuffs. You're sitting next to a clay jug with three X's on it that looks like something straight out of a cartoon.
Yeah. There's a lot of layers to that. Part of that was me just having fun with the scenery that was already happening.
The police car was just there.
The police car was there. And I mean, with as far as the jug goes, that's sort of a commentary on the state that a lot of Native American communities are in, and that there is alcoholism is pretty pervasive within those communities. And then also just, I'm not sure how to explain it, but having the bear being, you know, sort of looking like she's handcuffed or detained. Just talking a little bit about, like, the way that we approach animals and humans and empathy. There's a lot of themes going on there.
There's, you know, I've read in one version of your bio that you hope to bring Native American thought to our urban environment. And I wonder what that means to you.
It means a lot of different things. Because I grew up in, you know, the Ozarks, and I was raised by my, you know, my grandmother, my great-grandmother, and my mother, but I wasn't exposed necessarily to any of the native culture. My mom and dad were divorced. I didn't get any of that information at a young age. And so I had to learn a lot of it later on in life. And so it's sort of me just trying to figure out, like, where I fit in and how I make work that's mine and not Native American work. Yeah.
You have talked about spending a lot of time outdoors as a child in some of your artist statements. And I wonder if you can tell me about that piece of your childhood and how that comes into some of these ideas that you have.
Yeah. Well, after my mom and dad divorced when I was very young, we moved to Missouri, and in the Ozarks, it was in a community that was pretty isolated. We were very poor. And it was with my mother, my grandmother, my great-grandmother all in one house together. And so my very first exposure to art making was by making do with what you have. Being poor and being isolated, your options for making are going outside to play and using your imagination or learning a new skill. So those are the things that I was informed by as a child, growing up with, like, strong, sassy, independent women.
Do you remember thinking about the idea of an animal head and making an animal head for the first time? Because when you talk about using your imagination and being outdoors, this seems like almost a vision to me.
Yeah. Well, when I was a kid, a lot of the play that I did was like my grandmother would paint river rocks gold and then she'd hide them in the yard and I would pretend to be a prospector, which comes back to the whole, you know, like Western theme. But then, yeah, a lot of times when I was out playing, I was pretending to be an animal. And so when I think about these animals that I create, they're in their own world. Maybe I don't necessarily have access to that information of where they actually live, but we can all wonder and make up our own stories about it.
How long have you been in Kansas City?
Since 2009.
When had you been to the site that ended up being the location for your Open Spaces project, the building that now has a kind of bird family living in it?
I hadn't ever been there. I had been to the dog park several times with my puppy that was just like a minute away. But yeah, I had never been until Open Spaces happened.
When you first started exploring that space and finding things in it and looking really closely at it to imagine installing an art project there, did you feel like you were getting a window into a side of this part of our urban landscape that you didn't know before?
Yeah, definitely. And it's funny the way it all came together because it sort of feels like it was meant to be. Because the first thing that I had proposed to Open Spaces was this big blanket fort. But then Dan Cameron came to my studio.
The director.
Yes, the director of Open Spaces. He came to my studio and he saw the birds in the process. I had been making them long before I heard of Open Spaces. And he said, please submit this instead. I want these in the park. And I said, okay. And so, yeah, I had originally, they were going to be in a different shelter. And then when it got changed to that location, it sort of just like, it just all made sense for like what I'm doing and what Open Spaces is trying to do.
This being though, like an abandoned structure that of course most people don't typically have a reason to stop by, is there a story that you think that building tells that the rest of us who didn't spend, you know, however long you spent getting ready for this project should be thinking about?
Yeah, I think, you know, you drive past a lot of abandoned buildings in Kansas City. You drive past a lot of decay. And as beautiful as the city is, there is a lot that we ignore. And to go and inspect those places more thoroughly and directly, I think, gives you a completely different idea about what those places are and were and can be.
What's next for you?
The Charlotte Street Visual Arts Award exhibition is coming up next week, actually. So that's, October 11th.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you very much.
Jillian Youngbird, thanks so much for being here, and we're going to have to jog on out, but it's been great talking to you.
Thank you very much.
Jillian is a local artist, and her installation, For the Birds, is part of the Open Spaces Festival in Swope Park. The Open Spaces website has directions to see Jillian's art. Just go to openspaceskc.com, then click on participants and find Jillian's name, Jillian Youngbird. Both of the conversations from this morning's show will be at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Earlier, we spoke with Kansas author Sarah Smarsh, who's reading from her memoir, Heartland, at the Kansas City Public Library tonight. If you missed it, be sure and go back and check that out. Tomorrow, we will be airing a special documentary created here at KCUR. Our reporters will be taking us to Liberty, Missouri as part of our Here to Listen series. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Kathleen Pointer, and Suzanne Hogan. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't go away.